Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. On this program, we're going to return to learn the latest information on the prevention and treatment of HIV and AIDS. Our guests are Heather Davis, who's Executive Director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, and Dr. Beth Saltonstall. She's the Medical Director of the Sexually Transmitted Disease and HIV Program for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. If you've got questions or comments during the next hour, you can reach us at the following numbers, 550-8433, 550-8433. That's our local number. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Beth and Heather, welcome back.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. So this is the second time we've done this together.
Yes.
Or more. We've done AIDS a couple times, but I think we did this about a year ago.
We did.
And the way I remember it is December 1st is World AIDS Day.
It is.
Why is that important for us to remember?
World AIDS Day has been happening since 1988, and it's a time when everybody around the world comes together to show support for those living with HIV and to commemorate those that have been lost to the disease.
So we've actually lost lots of people. We'll learn today that the prognosis is probably better than it's ever been, but we're still having new infections at a pretty rapid rate around the world. But and the good news is there's lots of ways to prevent transmission more effectively all the time. And that can lead us to some lack of understanding of the importance of continuing to keep our eyes open about this disease, however. So let's get into a little bit of the basics again so that listeners can get re-upped on their education and those that are listening for the first time can have a better understanding of what we're dealing with. So, Beth, I'm going to ask you first. A lot of, I think, people that are non-medical or like me when I talk about my car, I've heard some of the words, but, man, I don't understand everything. So let's start with there's bacteria and viruses, and then there's fungi and all kinds of things. But let's just talk about bacteria and fungi and viruses and kind of begin with a little bit of difference between those for people, the important medical differences, perhaps.
Okay, well, bacteria, you have to remember, is a living organism. It's a cell. So when bacteria infects you, like pneumococcus or streptococcus or something, it's an invading cell, and you can treat that with an antibiotic, and it'll go away. And the other thing to remember, there's really good bacteria. If you didn't have gut bacteria, we'd be in a world of hurt. So there's a lot of good bacteria as well. But a virus is basically a protein coat with genetic material in it, and it needs a host. So viruses like HIV need to have a host cell in order to set up shop. They need a cell that they can invade and use the mechanism of that cell to reproduce themselves. And the problem with HIV is that it has not only cells that it infects in the bloodstream, but it's able to infect cells and lay latent in cells that are all throughout the body. We're not even really sure where that reservoir totally exists, but it can sit in those reservoirs, and our medications can help get the reproduction of the virus in the bloodstream decreased, but it doesn't touch that in those latent cells, so HIV lurks.
Bacteria, we are able to culture fairly frequently and even have some rapid tests for, like strep and some of the infectious diseases of our intestinal tract. And we've gotten to where we can do that to some degree with viruses as well, even though they're much, much tinier. And in fact, viruses even raise havoc with bacteria. That's right. Just to put things in some perspective. Bacteria don't bother viruses, but the other way around is very true. And you said there are healthy bacteria, but there's healthy, apparently, viruses as well.
There are
viruses. Yeah. Rather ubiquitous. I read something recently that there's a huge amount of virus material in our oceans. We're just beginning to recognize it might have some importance to us. All right, and so this particular virus, the human immunodeficiency virus, must do something to our immune system. That's how it got its name?
Exactly, yes. CD4 cells is the cell that HIV likes to reside in. And it's the cell that is actually supposed to help us, protect us from invasion of other species in our body. Dendritic cells line all mucosal surfaces, and they act as carriers. When the HIV gets through a mucosal surface, the dendritic cells will grab it and actually transport it to those CD4 cells whose job was to get rid of it. But what in actual events happens is that since it is a reverse transcriptase virus, it gets into the cell, takes over the mechanism, and then starts reproducing. So it destroys those CD4 cells that are so beneficial to us, and it also destroys the ability of those cells to make things like interleukin and tissue necrosis factor, those kinds of things that are also very effective in helping keep us healthy. So it has sort of a double whammy effect.
So I'm gonna bring that back to listeners a little bit better. You tell me if I'm saying this wrong again. So our immune system is adapted to survey the surface of our skin and our mucous membranes. Those are in our sinuses. If you want to know what a mucous membrane is, pull down your lower lip and take a look. That's a mucous membrane. It lines our intestinal tract, our bladder, our sinuses, our respiratory tract. And so there are cells, which you mentioned called dendritic cells, that are lurking around. And once they pick up foreign protein, and that could be peanut protein in a peanut butter that someone smears on their cut for whatever reason why they would do that, I don't know. But the point is this: those cells are picking up all kinds of proteins, including viral proteins and bacterial proteins. And their purpose is to bring that to our blood cells, particularly lymphocytes, the white blood cells, that are then going to be processed very simplistically. This is what we're saying is to recognize that in the future and prevent that infection from happening again. That's the ideal surface, sequence, overly simplified by a lot. But what happens is, I heard you say, is these dendritic cells are going to take in this virus exposed to our mucous membranes, the human immunodeficiency virus, and take it to a select group of these white blood cells we call CD4s, which are very important in helping us prevent viral infections. That virus attaches to that surface, gets incorporated into the CD4 cells, and steals its genetic makeup, in a sense. It starts making more cells. So what happens then?
Well, generally when people are initially infected, about 50 to 90% of people are going to get sick. They're going to feel like they have the flu. And the first thing that occurs is that there's this immense surge of HIV virus formed in the body, which will make you feel like you have the flu. You can have a sore throat, swollen lymph nodes. Fever is the most common effect of acute HIV. Sore muscles, you know, just the whole gamut. You're going to feel like you have the flu.
Not very specific.
Not specific at all.
You can't walk into a doctor and say, I got these things, and the first thing that's going to jump on his mind is you got HIV infection.
No, yeah. And that's part of what we need the medical profession to do is think that that we can get more people tested. But the other aspect is a possible rash. And rashes in adult diseases are fairly infrequent. It can be on the face, the trunk, palms of the hand, soles of the feet. So you have to think of syphilis, you know, if you're concerned about a rash as well. But the symptoms are pretty nondescript. Will last generally for a week to 3 to 4 weeks. And then for 5 to 10, 15 years, there are no symptoms. The virus is just reproducing itself. And it's not until your immune system has been affected to a point where it can't protect you from other normal diseases that you often come to the medical door asking for help.
Which is a big part of the problem, because people can be walking around with HIV for this 10 or 15 years, not know they have it, and be infecting other people, which is why testing is so highly recommended for everyone.
Yeah, very good point. And we want to definitely come back to this importance of testing, but also there's problems with the testing that relate to this natural history of the HIV. So again, what I'm hearing, just to reiterate so patients can hear, or patients, the public can hear, hopefully we have less patients, but the public can understand, is that initial illness is just like the body's response to many viral illnesses. It says, I'm going to take care of this infection. It pours out a lot of what we call in our work cytokines. These are chemicals designed to destroy that virus and take care of cells that are infected with the virus. And that's why we get fever and chills and headache and muscle pains. So it's very nonspecific, it seems like, for HIV. However, that viral genome, the part of that virus that is incorporated into our white blood cells and the DNA there, is now kind of off limits to our immune system. It does not take care of it completely. It's hidden, in a sense. Our body doesn't know that it's there, and it's quietly going along, injuring more and more and more of these cells. Is that why we have that period of time where things seem okay?
Exactly, yeah. And if someone who is chronically infected is and not diagnosed, is not on therapy, they're making about 10 billion copies of that virus every day. So it takes a lot of energy. It's a chronic inflammatory state that we're seeing with HIV. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of work for a body to keep producing all of that virus. Mm-hmm. And then eventually over time, it just gets tired.
Mm-hmm. So that virus, that's another point that I had forgot to really make clear, is that virus is constantly reproducing itself and being released as an infectious agent within the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it can be transmitted.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about testing then. We've got that picture. We haven't really discussed AIDS, the inconsequence of this infection, and we probably ought to come back. But testing is an important thing, Heather.
Testing is truly important for everybody, because like we said, you can be walking around with HIV and not know you have it. So testing is encouraged for everybody, even a baseline test for everybody, whether you think you're currently at risk or not.
So let me remind listeners once again, if you're listening to this program, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSK Anchorage, and we're talking about HIV and AIDS. Our guests are Heather Davis, Executive Director of the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association, and Beth Saltonstall, who is the Medical Director of the STD and HIV program at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Two phone numbers. If you've got questions, write down these numbers, 550-8433. That's our local number. And our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And finally, also during the next 45 minutes or so, you can email at line1 and spell it out, LINEONE, at alaskapublic.org. So what about more about the testing is important for us to know? What kind of testing is available? What does the public really need to know about testing?
I think one of the nice things for testing is that you can now get a rapid HIV test, which means you get your result in 20 minutes. So somebody can come into our office and get an HIV test. We can do an oral swab, and in 20 minutes, they know their test result.
About before we came on the air, we also talked about the availability of home testing. I have not, frankly, been out looking. Are those available in Anchorage, and what do we need to know about home testing?
They are available in Anchorage. They were coming on the market just about a year ago when we were on the show. I happened to look them up today, and they're $39.95 in places.
They've gone down.
They've gone down, because I think last year we thought they were around $60. You know, I have not heard any talk about the home test. I mean, we don't hear people saying that they've been using the home test to test. I don't know what the numbers are, how many of those test kits are going out the doors. Mm-hmm. I know there are some concerns.
Are they oral tests again?
They're oral swab tests, yes.
Oral swab.
Yes.
So you're taking some mucous membrane that harbors that virus, and there now the technology is very quickly you can tell if that virus is present. I would caution we need to ask Beth here about the pros and cons, but I really want to make sure people hear one thing. There is no perfect test out there, and there are lots of pros and cons about any test. A negative test should make you feel better, but it's not proof, and we'll talk about that. A positive test, there are false positives. So one of the concerns about this test is that people will misunderstand what's really going on. You want to expand on that, Beth?
Sure. And one of the things I wanted to highlight what you said, too, is this is not a saliva test. Because some people think, oh, it's a saliva test. Maybe HIV is in spit. Mm-hmm. HIV is not in spit unless there is visible blood. Mm-hmm. So it is a mucous membrane test, and it's a swab that's looking for antibodies. So if you have antibodies, that means that you've had the virus long enough for your body to have contacted it and to be fighting against it and to make antibody levels high enough for this test to read. Now, before antibodies are formed, there's a time frame in there that you may have virus, but no antibodies formed yet. And there's also a time frame in there that you may have virus, but it's not at a level that we can test for in your blood. Okay. So there is that, quote, window period that you have to be very cautious about. If you've been exposed within the last 1 to 3 months, you may actually show negative on one of these screens, even the ones you get at the doctor's office, mm-hmm. but you may have be in that acute or early stage of HIV. Mm-hmm.
So I was wrong, and I want to make it clear that the home test is a test for antibody, not the virus itself.
Right.
The medical establishment has tests that actually can identify the virus and actually count, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. they can actually quantify the amount of virus in the blood at any one time.
Right, and that's called our viral load. That's one of the things that we follow very closely in people because it is an indication of whether our therapy that we may be giving them is being effective. But there is no home viral load test at this time. That is a blood draw that has to be done through a medical office.
And the other thing is with both of those tests, there may be windows, particularly shortly after the infection for, you said, a couple of months, mm-hmm. where testing could be falsely negative. That is, you are infected, but the test will not pick it up.
Exactly, yeah.
So the recognition of that means that either you should delay testing with some problems related to that, or know that you may have to repeat if you think you've had a significant exposure.
Correct.
And I think the key with all of this is being honest with your provider. If you're going to see a provider, and make sure you let them know that you want to be screened. If you're concerned that you have risk factors that may put you at risk, ask them. Don't wait to be asked. For providers to make it just part of the practice. The CDC recommends everybody between the ages of 13 and 64 know their baseline, and that was ratified by the Preventive Task Force in April. So they actually changed the ages a little bit for some reason, but the implication of that being that they say, yes, this is a grade A recommendation. The benefits of testing far outweigh any negatives for it.
Well, let's talk about that again. I can imagine that there are individuals out there saying 13. I don't think my daughter or my son, even at 18, needs to be tested. And yet, what I'm reading in front of me is that more than one out of every four new HIV infections in the United States are among persons 13 to 24 years of age. So that we know. And we also know that most of them don't know they're infected. So they've not been tested or they've not been thoroughly detected enough. So then if one in every four cases is in that age group and they don't know they're infected, then they're continually putting other people at risk, potentially, and not treating themselves. So then, if I was a public health person interested in helping the whole country, I might say we should be testing everybody in that age group. That's the reasoning, is that right?
Absolutely.
So it makes sense. People sometimes jump to the conclusion that this is ridiculous, but once you look at the facts and you put yourself in the position of someone who's trying to protect the public,
that's what you need to do. You need to get people tested.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the percentage is about 18 to 20% of Americans that are estimated to be infected with HIV are unaware of their infection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a huge number.
So the next question, if you're thinking here, is what's the risk of transmission through various mechanisms of the HIV? So now we've determined that people can be infected. They may not easily recognize they have this infection for years. And they can then possibly go ahead and transmit this to other people. What are the mechanisms and what are the likelihood that those mechanisms will successfully transmit the illness to someone else?
Well,
general ideas, if we don't, I'm not asking for the specifics, but
The most likely transmission is going to be infected blood being injected into an uninfected person. Mm-hmm. So someone who shares needles when they're using drugs. Our blood supply is incredibly safe. There's a possibility of 1 in every 1 to 2 million units of blood that may have HIV virus in it. But that is the most effective, and I'm going to branch a little bit just to have Heather talk about how the 4As is helping to stem the transmission from the use of injecting needles.
Yeah, because we do know injection drug users are at huge risk for HIV, hepatitis C. So the 4As does run a syringe exchange where people can come in and get clean syringes to use. It's all based on a harm reduction model. If they have clean needles to use, it will prevent that spread of infection. It will also keep dirty needles off the street, out of the hands of people who might get a hold of them. So it's been proven to be highly successful. Syringe exchange programs are supported by the American Medical Association. Funding is difficult to get to run syringe exchanges, and the numbers that we see at the 4A are huge, the number of people who are looking for clean syringes, but they're there looking, and we get a chance to really educate people about the importance of using clean syringes, and they want to do that.
Is there any way to tell? So you said, what I heard you say is that there's a large number of people who take advantage of this program. The costs are high, and I don't know where the financial support comes from, but the costs are high. But what's the penetrance? What's the word? How effective is that in the overall scheme of numbers of people who are at risk with needle sharing? Do we follow my idea? I mean, is it 50% of people who are at risk to share needles are aware and can get, you know, clean syringes and clean needles, or we don't know for sure?
I have no idea what that number is. I think, you know, for us, as far as people coming into the syringe exchange, it's word of mouth. People mm-hmm. tell other people about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea what that number is out of the total population of, I don't know what the number of injection drug users is out there.
All right. What's the funding source for that?
There are two funding sources. They're both foundation grants that we get to help us with our supplies. And then actually the municipality of Anchorage gives us a little funding to staff it.
Mm-hmm. You ever run out of money?
Yes, we ran out this year. We couldn't meet the need for needles. We were up to 50,000 needles a month that we were handing out to people. And that was hard to pay for all that.
Has anybody ever looked at the cost effectiveness of these programs?
I think, you know, nationally it's been shown that they're cost effective in keeping HIV down. Hepatitis C right now, we partner with the state of Alaska, and they provide us test kits, rapid test kits, to do hepatitis C testing. Mm-hmm. Almost half of the people that we see in the syringe exchange test positive for hepatitis C, which is a much bigger concern for this group of individuals, actually, than HIV, but they're at risk for both.
Mm-hmm. Just as an indication that that system is working, the IV drug using new HIV infections is one of the rates that is significantly decreased due to needle exchange programs throughout the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So it's effective, it's cost effective, it's poorly funded, and it for all rational purposes, unless somebody can tell me another, it's something that we ought to be funding better and using more effectively.
Absolutely.
Very little of science against the reasons for using it, or evidence, I like to say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we said bloodborne exposures is the very highest risk. I mean, it's something like if you're infected and you share a needle, I mean, the odds are it'd be unlikely that you're not going to get HIV through that transmission. Is it? I mean, it seems like it's.
It seems like it should be a one on one, but it really is not.
I've looked at those numbers. Yeah. In fact, you can go to the CDC. If you put in CDC/AIDS or HIV, there are charts there that'll tell you exactly the numbers that we may not have on top of our heads. But that's the highest risk by far.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then the next is sexual transmission. And that is also stratified. You know, men who have sex with men who have anal sex, the receptive partner is going to be at the highest risk for acquiring HIV. Vaginal sex, oral sex, they've all been implicated. So that tells us that, you know, there's protection. You need to use protection regardless of what type of activity you're engaging in, because the condoms are protective, not 100%. They have to be used correctly, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. But that's our best barrier method at this time, both male and female condoms.
What else can be done to protect you?
Well, if you have an HIV-positive partner and you want to be further protected, the best thing you can do is have that partner on antiretroviral therapy, because it has been shown that treatment is prevention, and about 96% decrease in transmitted HIV from those who are treated with what we call undetectable. It doesn't mean it's gone, just means the machine can't see it, an undetectable viral load. Those people are 96% less likely to transmit to their partners than people who are not on antiretroviral therapy. And also that if they take PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is a one pill once a day regimen, there's a lot involved in it. It's not like you can just get the pill and take it and live happily ever after. You need to have blood testing and make sure that your body is handling it appropriately as well, because there are side effects that need to be monitored. But that also has been shown, if taken on a consistent basis, to be a tremendous benefit for prevention. Circumcision. Men who are circumcised are less likely to acquire HIV from their female partners. What am I missing?
How about spermicidal gels and things like that? Do you know off the top of your head?
Those have been very disappointing to date. Mm-hmm. The research continues, and there's always hope on the horizon, but there hasn't been a really good spermicidal gel that women can use without knowledge of partners. That's part of the reason why they're being looked at, so that women can take charge of themselves, that have been really effective. But that's still an area of deep research involving the same medications that you can take for the PrEP.
So first off, it helps to know if your partner is potentially at risk of infecting you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then there are condoms, and there are actually the ability for married couples to decrease their likelihood of transmission. And actually, within families, even before some of this, there was not tremendous spread person to person. So there's a huge difference between a needle stick exposure with somebody infected and any form of sex, although some forms of sex are greater. But there are couples who live together for a long time and were able to keep themselves from transmitting it to their other partner. Mm-hmm. So that needs to be understood. Quickly, we need to take a break, but we kind of glanced over a little bit. A needle stick exposure to a hospital or somebody's working has got some risk, but really it's not. A single needle stick exposure is much different than sharing an IV needle, if I'm correct about that. I mean, it's still some risk, but
it all depends on what the needle was used for. There hasn't been a documented case of a solid needle transmission of HIV to a healthcare worker.
Okay.
However, if someone has been withdrawing blood into a needle, visible blood, and has that injected, they are at increased significant risk, and they take PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis.
Okay.
And in the same picture as with PrEP, it's to prevent the body from being able to have that virus take control. And the key to it is get to the ER, get the medications even before you start talking about it. If you've had a significant risk as a bloody needle, hollow bore needle exposure.
Yeah, and that's fairly recent bits of information, because I probably would not have answered that question as that you could do that, or I should be thinking about that with employees in my office. So I need to admit that. And so how long has that recommendation been around? Less than a year or
No, that's
longer?
Been a long time. Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
All right, so I apologize. I did not know that possibility existed, or didn't remember knowing it. So let's take our typical break right now. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Once again, our local number is 550-8433. You can also call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email us during the next 35 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll continue our conversation with Heather Davis and Dr. Beth Saltonstall. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is HIV and AIDS. What we're trying to do is bring ourselves up to date on the latest about who's at risk and how we prevent infection and what's really new in treatment and its effectiveness. So you can email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433. And always our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. The usual proviso, if you're listening between 9 and 10 on Monday evening, you're listening to tape rebroadcast, so we will not be able to answer questions at that time. However, also remember that if you want someone else to listen to this program or you would like to listen to yourself again, you can go to Line 1 Archives at alaskapublic.org. And this program and any prior program in the very distant past, we have quite a few of those programs on our archives, and they can be listened to, or you can refer someone else to listen to those again. Beth, as we were moving along, we got HIV infection. We got this virus taking over our immune cells, our CD4 lymphocytes in particular. And we left it as it could take years before AIDS developed. We talked about the fact that during that period of time, most people are generally pretty healthy, except right after they first acquire the infection. So bring us up to AIDS. What happens then? What is acquired autoimmune deficiency syndrome encompass in the way of symptoms? And after that, I want to bring Heather back in to talk about the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association.
Okay, well, you know, AIDS is the end product of having the virus for years. And there are 27 different entities that constitute the diagnosis of AIDS. The most common one that we see is having a CD4 count. Now, those are those CD4 cells we were talking about earlier that are infected. Normal counts are between 350 and 1,500. And by CDC definition, when those cells get down below 200, that is their definition of AIDS. Tuberculosis, cervical cancer, bacterial pneumonias within a year. Those are other things that we see that are AIDS diagnosis. But, you know, we're kind of getting away from that. Because our current therapies are so good, people generally are not advancing to AIDS anymore. So when people present with AIDS and are being diagnosed with HIV and AIDS at the same time, that means they've had the disease for a long time and they're presenting with AIDS. But usually those that are diagnosed within the HIV realm and they're in care, those people can live normal lives. So when you ask what the presenting symptoms of somebody with AIDS would be, it really varies. AIDS, immune system that's been compromised, you can see typical diseases that will present very atypically, such as people with herpes can have horrible herpes outbreaks that don't clear. People with seborrheic dermatitis can have horrible seborrheic dermatitis that's untreatable. Psoriasis, those kinds of things can be exaggerated when people have their immune system that is compromised to the point of having that, quote, AIDS diagnosis, end quote.
So because of the effectiveness of treatment, AIDS is decreasing, death from AIDS is decreasing,
right.
But HIV infection continues to be an issue, and the emphasis is on detecting those that are infected to help them not become victims of AIDS,
right.
And also to prevent transmission to others.
Exactly.
And it's really become about chronic disease management, right. Because it has become a chronic disease.
And the AIDS is a consequence of our immune system being destroyed, so to speak, a certain component of our immune system, and that leads to increased risk of cancers and other types of infections that may give them trouble, but not particularly bacteria, but we don't need to get into that necessarily. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We don't necessarily have to get it's the cancers and viruses, of which viruses certainly do cause cervical cancer, and they probably cause some head and neck cancers, and so we're becoming more and more convinced of the fact that viruses are a significant cause of significant numbers of cancers.
Mm-hmm.
All right, tell us about the 4 A's.
So the 4 A's has been around since 1985. We're the primary organization to provide services to people living with HIV and also prevention education. We serve all of the state of Alaska. With the exception of Fairbanks area, there's the Interior AIDS Association in Fairbanks, which covers that population. We're based here in Anchorage, but we also have an office in Juneau to serve clients in the southeast region. So we're there to provide medical case management for those people who are living with HIV and AIDS. We partner closely with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, who we often share clients with, and then also to try to educate the public to prevent this disease from happening in the first place.
And your funding?
We get a variety of streams of funding for the care and case management of our clients. It mostly comes through what's called Ryan White funding. It comes from the federal government, but it's actually funneled through the state of Alaska. That's our primary provider for most of our HIV care and some of our prevention dollars.
I know we talked briefly about the funding a little bit, and my understanding is it's really somewhat unclear now with the Accountable Care Act what's going to happen. Is that with the Ryan White funding, which is a principal source of your funding, is that fair to say, or am I overstating it?
With the Affordable Care Act, there's still a lot of unknowns. You know, they're still working out the system. We will enroll clients as soon as that system becomes more available. We're in the federal system here in Alaska, so there are two options for people to choose from. Nobody really knows right now the extent of how that will affect Ryan White funding. The original thought was that as Medicaid expansion increased in states, that they could start decreasing the Ryan White funding because those clients would move over to the expanded Medicaid. With some states not expanding Medicaid, we don't know what the follow-up is, and hopefully the Ryan White funding will stay there to still provide for those particular groups of people. So there's still so many unknowns with, the whole ACA. So it's hard to say yet. We're right in the beginning of it. So I don't know that we know the implication of the big picture.
We'll tell you next year.
We'll tell you next year, hopefully.
Well, it would seem to be a bad case of shooting yourself in the foot if funding does not continue in some way.
Well, absolutely. You know, we see it with prevention, too. Alaska is a low-incidence state. Federal funding has been targeted for the big metropolitan areas. So, for instance, our funding decreased by half last year. We took a big loss in funding, and said that we aren't able to go on and do as much education and training. We mm-hmm. basically can do HIV testing, and then we do statewide condom distribution, but we're limited mm-hmm. in the amount of outreach that we can do now. So eventually, I think it catches up to you, and a few years down the road, we'll see more cases, and shoot, it's too bad we didn't have that money up front to prevent it.
Well, let's take a little jog back. I don't think we really ferreted out the epidemiology of HIV infection in Alaska too well here. And when I say epidemiology, we're talking about the who, what, when, where, and how that we know from looking into these cases about AIDS. So what are the pertinent numbers for our state?
So in our state from 1982 up into 2012, there's been about 1,482 cases of HIV. So we are considered a low-incidence state. Of course, we have a low population as a state. And about 55% of those were in whites. And about 49% of those were men having sex with men. So those are the biggest numbers.
I mentioned the situation about young persons aged 13 to 14, about one-fourth of new infections. Are you able to say that still makes sense in Alaska.
Our population tends to be a little bit older.
Older, yeah, mm-hmm. definitely yeah. older. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things that we hear as far as misconceptions, especially from young people, is that getting HIV is no big deal. We often hear them say that. It's no big deal. I can take a pill and that's the extent of it. So there doesn't seem to be the concern about it that I think people who were alive when the epidemic was at its, you know, going full tilt and, mm-hmm. and understand what was happening, they missed that. And so to them, it's not as big a concern.
So misconceptions is always a question I like to ask about. So let's focus on this. What do you mean that a teenager says it's no big deal, I'll just take a pill? Is it just one pill?
That's what they think.
Well, and it so can be.
And it can be.
There's a big if it could be one pill.
Well, we've got three available now and another one pill a day coming down the pike.
You mean, but it's one pill for how long?
The rest of their lives. Until
Exactly.
And
all right,
it's not
so it's
one
simplified.
Pill.
Yeah. It's not three or four, yeah. but it's not one pill.
It's not for the 14 days or until your symptoms resolve. No, it's for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Until we find a cure.
And the cost of that one pill per year?
For one of our most common regimens that is a one pill once a day, it's $2,250 a month. That's the over-the-counter cost that the CDC puts out, the wholesale cost that the CDC puts out in their guidelines. So if you've
not
got an extra
feed.
$2,250 a month, then
and
you
it's
can
gotten,
take it
to be honest, a little bit cheaper than it used to be, or less expensive, but it's still a significant problem.
Yeah, well, and that's just the pill. That doesn't include doctor's visits and lab tests and everything else that goes along with that.
How effective can we tell this teenager who thinks it's just a pill if I get infected? How effective is this going to be?
I don't want to give any encouragement, but a 25-year-old that's diagnosed with HIV today gets into care, maintains their antiretrovirals, can expect to have a normal lifespan.
There's another if that we've talked about already, and that is if you know you're infected.
If you know. Mm-hmm.
And so young adults in most parts of the United States, maybe not entirely here, are 1/4 of the new cases, and the vast majority of them don't know they're infected. So, again, it gets back to common sense tells you you need to know if you're infected for yourself and for those others you may be putting at risk.
And I'm going to take a step back. Mm-hmm. You need to take the precautions so that you don't have to worry
infected.
About
right.
being infected. Yeah. One of the things that we're seeing, not only in Alaska, but around the United States is the increased use of the internet for finding partners and for hooking up. So anonymous partners from the internet are one of the biggest drivers of not only HIV but syphilis right now.
All right, so let's go down that road. So I know I've had a test. I did the home test and I was negative. So I'm telling my potential partners over the internet, I know I am not infected. Is that what you're saying is happening?
That can happen. I don't know that there's that much thought that often goes into it, but that would be good to know that if that's what they're doing.
Somebody feels that they're safe.
Yes.
And that may not be true.
And it may not be true, again, because of that window
period
we talked about before.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, like you said, not all tests are perfect.
Right.
And if they kept the test under the seat of their car last night and thawed it out this morning to check and see what was going on, it's not going to be an effective test. So.
And if you're going to have sex, then a condom is the best protection. Not 100%. Nothing is 100%. But it's our most effective protection.
Used correctly.
Yeah. Other than some PrEP treatment. If we knew we were at risk, we could take some in treatment pretty quickly, and that would help. But that is not cost-effective and not recommended for the general
for
public.
For casual sex, no. Yeah. And it is that also is an everyday, not just, you know, I'm going out on Friday night, I'm going to start taking this med on Wednesday and quit on Monday. This is an everyday pill that you take for pre-exposure.
Okay.
Yes, condoms are definitely the important part. The other part is knowing your partner, talking about it, being open and being honest.
All right, Elizabeth, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Elizabeth, are you still there? Nope. She hung up. We were on the treatment, and one of the questions I had written to myself is you used the word antiretroviral, and I'd just like you to explain not necessarily what antiretroviral means, but how do these medications work?
Once the cell has entered, or once the HIV virus has injected its genetic material into the cell that it's going to reproduce in, there's very many steps that go through. It breaks its RNA, makes it into DNA, puts it into the cell mechanism or the nucleus mechanism of the cell, produces the proteins, regroups them together, and releases them. Every one of those steps has some type of a protein or a retrovirus or an integrase inhibitor or something that is important for that step to take place. Also into the entry of the cell, there's important steps that have to take place. So every antiretroviral, every medication that we have that works against this virus works at one of those steps of the life cycle of the HIV.
Okay.
So we don't want to have just one step covered. All of the we call it HART, H-A-A-R-T, highly active antiretroviral therapy, all of our HART regimens have medications from at least two different classes of medications to make sure that we're covering that HIV replication at various steps.
All right, so let me take the listening public on a little bit longer thought process here. These viruses have been around for a long time. We've done a program here with an excellent infectious disease expert from the University of Waterloo in Canada, who has written a very extensive research project on the origins of AIDS, and it appears that AIDS have probably been in the human population since the early 20s in Africa. So these viruses probably jumped into humans from chimpanzees and a very select group of chimpanzees. So what I'm saying is the viruses and bacteria and other organisms have been around a heck of a lot longer, if you stop thinking of them, we have, and they're very good at surviving. So where I'm going is bacteria we are hearing every day are developing resistance to antibiotics, and we're running out of antibiotics, so to speak. And in fact, pharmaceutical companies don't make much money off antibiotics, so there's not much pressure for them to develop antibiotics. Well, the same thing happens to antiviral agents. Are HIV viruses becoming resistant? Have they become resistant? What's the likelihood that that will continue to be a worry?
The key
fact, if you're going to take just a medication every day.
Yeah. And the key is
every day. For the rest of your life, as far as
life,
we know.
Yes.
Yeah. Until something better comes. Yeah.
And it's coming. It's coming down the pike. I think it's going to happen in our lifetime. But the key to treating HIV is compliance. You have to take your medication every day. Or, yes, that virus, it multiplies so quickly and it mutates so quickly that it can get around some of these medicines that we're using. And it makes mutations that make it resistant to that particular antiretroviral. The benefit we have today that we didn't have even 5 years ago is that we have new classes of medications that are, every one of them seems to be better and more effective than the one before. So if I had been talking to you 5 years ago, we had people on what we call salvage therapy, handful of pills, everything we can sort of throw them, plus the kitchen sink, to try to treat their HIV. Now we're able to be more selective. We have a bigger opportunity to treat people who may be failing. But we can't guarantee that this is going to continue. You know, people really do have to take their meds so that they don't get that resistance. Currently in the U.S., about 11%, am I right with that? About 11% of people are being transmitted virus, HIV virus, that already has some resistance to at least one class of our medication. So it is a huge issue, yes.
I'm going to expand just a little bit on this this issue of resistance to organisms to make a bigger point. And so what's happening is these organisms, particularly bacteria and viruses, are reproducing so fast, so many, that inevitably with any reproductive system, there's going to be some errors. And every once in a while, an error comes along that says, okay, now this error keeps me from that bacteria from being affected by penicillin, like the previous gazillion bacteria that were sensitive. And now that one, every time it's exposed to penicillin, doesn't get affected. So it has a selective advantage to continue to grow. Same thing happens with viruses. And my bigger point is that's evolution. Mm-hmm. That is how evolution works. That's why we have different species of dogs. That's why we have different species of cats. That's why we have different species of bacteria. And that's why bacteria continue to be an issue, and why viruses continue to be an issue. No matter how good we get, it's a big nuclear war going on out there, and they get good at it. So you said that the long-term prognosis for control of this illness is even better in our lifetime. What were you saying? what do you think's going to happen over time?
Over time, I think that the way that science is working right now and the areas of HIV that they're looking at, rather than looking at the particular particles of the virus and all the rest of that, they're looking at how the body reacts to the virus, and they're looking at cure and vaccine from that standpoint. One of the cases that I think we talked about last year as well is the Berlin case, through a complicated series of events got a bone marrow transplant from somebody that was unable to advance HIV once they were infected, and that's a whole different discussion, but there are about 5% of the population that are like that. And he remains, I think this is 5.5, maybe 6 years, free of HIV. And there are other people that they have tried that on now that are also successful. So I think in our future, HIV is still going to be an incredibly important disease, but I think we're going to find ways to get around it.
Mm-hmm. So the vaccine has got a huge amount of money being spent, and it is a obviously not an easy disease to develop a vaccine. I mean, that's self-evident. We have not been able to do it. But we're learning more and more about how our immune system reacts. And as my understanding of the Berlin patient is, there are a few of us out there who really don't have the right receptor protein on their cells. So they get the infection, but that virus has got to somehow latch on to the CD4 cells. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have this certain protein that you didn't inherit, it can't latch on. You don't get infected. Mm-hmm. And in this situation where somebody got a bone marrow transplant, that's what helped. Another thing I've heard recently, I haven't heard how reliable this is, but there was a baby born that got infected from the mother and very quickly was treated, really off-label use of the medications, I might add, but made sense to do this. Somebody had to eventually do it. And to date, my understanding is that baby who clearly was infected was cured of that infection because of the early use of these antiretrovirals. Is that also
that true? That's what the literature is saying, yes. Yep. And the baby, you're right, was hit very early, I mean almost immediately, and really hard with antiretrovirals that generally are not used in infants. And they really treated her effectively for 18 months until she disappeared. And then mom got lost to follow-up. And when they did come back for follow-up, they were amazed to see that the baby did have no detectable virus in her blood. And that leads us, too, to people who are acutely infected, that there is discussion now that because of this, that perhaps we need to be aggressively treating people who are newly infected with HIV to help protect their immune system and possibly have the same effect that was occurred with the infant. Now, the other thing that you have to remember with the infant is that she also had mom's antibodies. Mm. So she had benefits from both medications and antibodies that had already been determined to be, you know, not totally effective in eradicating the virus, but had undoubtedly had some effect on that specific virus that she got from mom. So I think there's a benefit.
So what's the risk of a baby being born to a mother who's actively infected of acquiring AIDS in general? Do you know that off the top of your head?
It's more concerning if they acquire HIV during their infection or during their pregnancy, because at that time that has that massive viral load component. But overall, if you look at women who are untreated with HIV and deliver a baby, their risk of transmitting to that infant is 25%. Mm-hmm. If they just get AZT during delivery, that goes down to 9%. And if they're on antiretroviral therapy and have an undetectable viral load, their chances of transmission to the infant are about 1.8%.
There's been some information recently sent to pediatricians, made it into the newspaper, that a lot of breast milk that's being shipped around the country for use is infected with bacteria, and so there may be transmission. What about HIV potentially being infected across breast milk?
That's an excellent question, and yes, breast milk is about 12% additional. And you have to keep in mind, too, that premastication of food is another risk factor in HIV-positive women to their children.
All right. We're in the last couple of minutes. What are the critical things we want people to remember from today? Heather?
Get tested. Use condoms each and every time. That it hasn't gone away. That we need to remember every day 6,300 people contract HIV, and that's 262 people an hour. That's a lot of people who are still coming down with this disease that don't necessarily need to.
It's worldwide.
And
those numbers are unfortunately much better. There's been a lot of headway made, particularly in Africa, as we talked about before the program. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Yeah.
Beth?
I agree with Heather wholeheartedly, and I think that you don't have to have this disease. Be careful. Know yourself. Know your partners. If you are infected with HIV, stay in care, because that's not only the best for you, but it's the best for your partners and the people that you love. And I think on World AIDS Day, we need to remember all of those that have passed away from HIV and AIDS and let them be our mentors in keeping ourselves safe and going forward for an HIV-free future.
Where can people go in Anchorage or in Alaska to get free confidential testing? Is that possible?
Yeah, there are places where you can go. You can come to our office, and we can give you an HIV test in Juneau. Some places have sliding fee scales, Planned Parenthood, the Muni. So it's possible to get a free HIV test. And not to be afraid to get a test, I think, too.
Where are you located and your phone number?
Our phone number is 263-2050. We're on 1057 West Fireweed Lane, right at the intersection almost with Spinard.
And if you want to find an easy way to find where to get tested for HIV, you can go to iknowmine.org. And there is a site there where you can just click on, put in your zip code, and it will tell you all the testing facilities in your area.
All right. Thanks again. My guests today were Heather Davis, from the Executive Director of Alaska AIDS Assistance Association, and Dr. Beth Saltonstall, the Medical Director of the STD-HIV Program at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. If you'd like to continue this conversation on HIV and AIDS, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org, and also you can find Line 1 archives at that same address. Next week, you're going to return, and Prentice Pemberton is going to be the host for another one of his programs on his series on parenting today's teenagers. So social media, smartphones, the internet, maybe even sex. That's what their discussion will be. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, November 25th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 9 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and engineer today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.